there isn't anything that can stand up against the truth. And I believe that, I think, to some degree, because it just seems self-evident. It's like, if the truth is deeply reflective of the structure of reality, the claim that the lie can dominate is the claim that the unreal can defeat the real. Mm. And that's, you are literally insane if you believe that.
He's a clinical psychologist and a professor and a best-selling author, but I think the greatest thing about him is his commitment to unwavering truth. He just will not bullshit about things. He tells the truth and he digs in and he's willing to look for the truth. He doesn't believe he just has it, but he also studies what I really wanted him to chat with us about today is in the middle of all this chaos, seemingly chaos, there is a larger order. And the large order can be found by studying the stories of humanity. You know, the hero's journey is one of those stories. And perhaps, you know, he studies all the great religious texts, but he's been doing a whole series some of you may have seen on the Bible, different portions of the Bible. Please help us welcome our friend, amazing soul, Dr. Jordan Peterson, everybody. Give it up for him. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's good to see you. Good to see all of you there. Thank you for that introduction.
Our pleasure. You have the floor, my dear friend.
Well, I think we'll take off from that intro. The first thing I should let everybody know, this is a conclusion that people have come to across a variety of different disciplines. Literary criticism, computer intelligence, robotics, study of perception from the physiological perspective, a real coming together of observations across multiple disciplines. And so here's the fundamental realization. We have to see the world through a story. In fact, if you describe to someone the structure through which you see the world, what you're actually doing is telling them a story. So here's a way to think about it. When you go see a movie, it grips you emotionally. And the reason that happens is because the filmmaker, the writers, provide you with some insight into the goals of the characters. And when you can adopt someone else's goals, you can align your emotions with their emotions. And that means that you can feel what they feel, and that means that you can understand them. And so, if you adopt the story that someone else is telling, then you can literally mimic them. You can mimic their nervous system with yours. That, and you have that feeling of being in sync with someone or in tune with someone. And you have that feeling because that's exactly what's happening. So not only do we have to see the world through a story, but the story that we see the world through determines how we respond to things emotionally. So this is a useful thing to know. You know, if the world is unfolding for you in a manner that you don't find particularly acceptable, if you're anxious and upset and depressed and hurt and hopeless, one possibility is that you're not looking at the world through a particularly productive story. Now, once you understand that you have to look at the world through a story, or that it's inevitable that you will, another question immediately arises, which is, well, what story do you or should you see the world through? And that's the subject of great debate. In fact, the whole cultural war that we're in at the moment, that's turning everything into a kind of chaos, is actually a debate between the promoters of different stories. Now, the postmodern and neo-Marxist types, they tend to insist either that all our stories are fragmented and subjective and hedonistic at their base. There's no such thing as an overarching uniting narrative. That was the claim of the French postmodernists. Or there's an alternative claim, which is that the only story that really unites people, the only story that really exists, is one of power, and that you can see the whole world as a reflection of the competition between different stories of power. So when you hear the Marxist types, for example, make the claim that our culture is nothing but an oppressive patriarchy, and that marriage is an oppressive institution, and that all economic relationships are merely those of exploitation. You're hearing an insistence that the only story that people can live out is the story of domination and oppression and victimization and mutual exploitation. It's an unbelievably dismal view of humanity. It also justifies the use of power on behalf of the people who put forward the story, because if there's no motivating ethos other than domination, then it's perfectly reasonable for you to use nothing but domination in your attempts to deal with other people. Now, that's a very pathological story. I would also say, by the way, it's a very counterproductive story. You know, you might say that people who wield power can become remarkably successful. You could point to dictators, for example, like the man who runs North Korea, and say, well, Dr. Peterson, you claim that power isn't a very productive story and that it doesn't work very well in the long run. But if you look at brutal societies like North Korea, you see that people who are perfectly willing to use power rise to the highest positions. How can you describe that as anything other than success? And I would say, just because you're the biggest devil in hell doesn't mean that you've won the game. In fact, quite the contrary. And you can attain a position of dominance through force, but if you don't think you'll pay a price for that, you're a bloody fool. Alexander Solzhenitsyn did quite a nice job of investigating the psychological state of Joseph Stalin, for example. And Stalin was clearly the most powerful man in the world's most corrupt country, which made him the biggest devil in that particular form of hell. And you might say, well, what did he gain for his trouble? And I can tell you what he gained. It was that every single person around him lied about absolutely everything all the time. He had no true friends. He just had sycophants who wanted to be near a bully. He distrusted everyone. He had contempt for everyone, of course, because he was so terrifying that people conducted themselves atrociously around him. He engaged in a variety of quasi-genocidal enterprises. He was a murderous thug, and he ended up likely murdered. And, you know, it isn't obvious to me at all that any of that constitutes success. And so that's the typical outcome of strategies that are based on power. It's not advisable. Now, you can think about this in your own life. You know, maybe you've used instrumental and manipulative means to get to where you want to go, and maybe you think that's necessary. But I would say you don't want to have a marriage where the fundamental relationship is one of power, where one of you is a tyrant and the other is a slave, and maybe you alternate roles, but there's no reciprocity or mutuality there. There's no genuine love and regard. There's just force. And you certainly don't want friendships that are predicated on that presumption. You want to be around people who want to be around you, not people that you forced or otherwise enticed or manipulated into being around you. And then on the business front, many of you are very successful. And those of you who are properly successful know perfectly well that the way that you establish a business that has a good probability of surviving into the medium and long term is to make contracts with the people that you work with that are to your mutual benefit, right? So your interests are aligned, so that you're thrilled to be working together, and then to offer your customers genuine service and value for the money. And none of that's about exploitation, and none of that's about power. It's a completely different ethos. And so you might ask yourself, well, if you're going to characterize the ethos that isn't power, that unites people, that stabilizes them psychologically and provides for social unity, how would you characterize that? And Tony made some reference to this, and there are archetypal themes that echo throughout human history that detail out the fundamental story of life. And one of the most fundamental of those, there's probably two. There's an adventure story and a romance story, but I'll start with the adventure story. And the adventure story is essentially the myth of the hero. And the myth of the hero, which is, by the way, is the story that our culture, Western culture, is predicated on, and I would say all functional stories, posits that human beings are not automatons or clockwork machines that are driven by deterministic functions, but creatures that constantly confront what you might describe as a transforming horizon of possibility. So imagine, you know, when you get up in the morning, what confronts you, your consciousness is not so much the furniture in your room and the things that you can see that are right in front of you, but the possibilities of the day. The possibilities of the day open up as that vast domain of potential occurrences that you can play some role in determining. You're going to be thinking about the problems that you have that need to be solved, and you're going to be thinking about the opportunities that beckon to you that you could, in principle, take advantage of and utilize, if you have any sense, to your medium and long-term advantage and simultaneously to the advantage of the other people around you. And so you're contending with a realm of possibility, and you shape that with your vision. And the way that that's portrayed in mythologies of the hero is generally with some motif that's analogous to that of a dragon fight. And so you can think about St. George in that regard, and the ancient story is something like this. It's the story of the Hobbit, by the way. It's the story of the Lord of the Rings. It's the story of Harry Potter. It's the story of the movie Jaws. It's deeply embedded in the biblical corpus. It's Star Wars. It's everywhere, this story, is that there's a city and it's threatened by the emergence of ancient chaotic forces that were once under control. And a hero emerges who notes the onset of this threat and who decides to step outside the bounds of the city and confront this creature, dragon often. And a dragon, by the way, a dragon is a symbolic representation of a predator. You know, people say there's no such thing as a dragon, but it's an imaginary creature. It's like, that's actually not true. What a dragon is an amalgam of the features of the creatures that have classically preyed upon human beings. So it's a predatory bird and a predatory cat and a predatory reptile and the destructive force of fire all combined. And so dragon and predator, dragon is the image of predator. And the ancient human idea is that our consciousness, our heroic consciousness, is that which moves out into the world to confront the eternal predator and to overcome it. Now, we obviously do that because we can protect ourselves and our children from predatory beasts. We can also protect ourselves from predatory people, and we can protect ourselves from the predator that lurks in our own heart. That's more of a spiritual twist on the classic St. George and the dragon story, let's say, which is in variant forms the oldest story that we know. What's the idea? Well, the eternal dragon of chaos always threatens the habitable city. And people who are awake and alert and who are acting in accordance with the highest ethical principles become aware that such a threat exists and then decide to confront it voluntarily. And that's the image of the knight, let's say, armored knight, confronting the dragon in its lair. Now, interestingly enough, it's classically the case that predatory beasts, dragons, let's say, hoard treasure. They also hoard virgins, strangely enough. And the reason they hoard treasure is quite straightforward. It's because that which you most need to find is always lurking where you least want to look. That's a good leitmotif for life. So you could imagine that there are things in your life that you're avoiding that you know you should do, that you don't want to confront, that frighten you, that activate your predator detection systems, let's say. And if you can learn to organize yourself so that you have enough courage to take on that chaotic unknown, then you'll discover things about yourself and the world that you don't know and master them. And the consequence of that will be that you'll be rewarded. And that's, of course, the treasure that the dragon eternally guards. And the rule of thumb is fundamentally, well, the larger the dragon, the more likely you're going to get eaten. But by the same token, the larger the treasure. The virginal motif in that story is the motif of the virgin, is that women are, what would you say, deeply inclined to be attracted to male figures who are capable of taking on chaos and prevailing. So if you're the sort of person who can confront the unknown in a visionary manner and you can shape it into the cosmos that's habitable and good, then that also makes you maximally attractive as a partner. And that, as I said, that's the oldest story we know. In fact, the oldest written story we know is a Mesopotamian story called the Enuma Elish, where the main hero, Marduk, is in fact a St. George-like figure who confronts a dragon who threatens the entire world with destruction. And so, and that's, well, that's essentially the motif of most adventure stories. Sometimes the hero confronts a giant instead of a dragon, and the giant is usually a symbol of something like the corrupt state. So, you know, there's two variants of heroes, and one variant of hero confronts chaos as such, just disorder and uncertainty, and the other variant of hero confronts corrupt gigantism. That's a good way of thinking about it. And that's another eternal enemy of human progress on the psychological and social front, right? The tendency of organizations to develop into tyrannical giants that have to be slain in order for proper order to be established. And so that story of confrontation with chaos is extraordinarily deeply rooted in Western culture. You see it expressed in its most fundamental form, arguably, in Christianity, because the crucifix itself is a symbol of something like chaos. So imagine, if you're thinking about this psychologically, one of the things you might ask yourself is, why have we collectively been gazing, for example, at this terrible figure of the crucifix for 2,000 years? And to get a sense of how shocking that is, imagine that the object of worship was a man hanging with a broken neck from a noose. It's exactly the same kind of image. It's an image of state-sponsored torture, fundamentally. It's an image of, what would you say? It's an image of the sum total of all vulnerable possibilities. And so in the Christian story, the eternal Redeemer, who's in principle the model for behavior, is the person who voluntarily takes on the entire chaotic weight of existence. And so in Christ's passion, all the terrible things that can happen to any particular person are amalgamated together and form part of his catastrophic adventure. And so you could imagine in your own life, and this has already happened to many of you in many ways, well, what terrible things might happen to you? Well, you can be hurt physically, badly. You can be tortured, let's say. You can be put to death. You could be tortured physically and be put to death young. That could happen as a consequence of being betrayed. It could happen as a consequence of being betrayed by someone extremely close to you, let's say your best friend or your marital partner. It could happen because the state turns against you. It could happen because the state turns against you even at the hands of your own people. And that could happen to you even if you were innocent. And so you can see that in some ways that's the sum total of all possible fears. And the crucifix is an image of the sum total of all possible fears. And the reason that it's a redemptive symbol, at least in part, is because, and this is why there's a Christian injunction, let's say, to pick up your cross and stumble uphill with it, let's say, to pick up your cross and bear it. The idea is that you're going to be best prepared to take on the true difficulties of your life by confronting the potential existence of all of those problems before they make themselves known. Because I could say, if you all wanted to be more resilient in your life, and that would mean less stressed, that would mean less anxious, mean less subject to pain and depression and nihilistic thoughts, and more able to spring back when trouble visited you, one of the ways that you could make yourself more resilient would be to envision, for example, how you would react to, well, perhaps bad medical news on your behalf or on the behalf of someone you love, or betrayal by someone close to you, including yourself, or being potentially mobbed and alienated by your social group or your ethnic group or your political group, or being subject to the tyranny of the state or your own weakness. To walk through that and to face that as a, what would you say, as a inevitable likely reality and to fortify your character in, what would you say, in preparation for that eventuality. And you could ask yourself, as sensible people, well, how the hell could it possibly be any different? You know perfectly well that you're not going to be prepared to confront anything that you avoid. Obviously, how can you prepare yourself to confront something that you're going to avoid? And given that you know that your life is going to be rife with a set of irreducible difficulties, how could you possibly be any better prepared than to face that beforehand and to understand that that's part of your destiny? And then even more, to take that on as voluntarily, as something that you're not only willing to do, but maybe capable of learning to do, well, with, I suppose, in a spirit of radical acceptance, and maybe even now and then, something approximating joy. You know, it's a lot to ask for, right? That you have to maintain your moral compass and your hopeful optimism in the face of the worst that can happen to you. But what the hell's your alternative? You know, if the chickens do come home to roost and things start to go badly for you, and you are terrified by that and embittered as a consequence, and then you turn away from what's positive and highest, all that's going to happen, clearly, is that your suffering is going to get a lot worse and that you're going to distribute that suffering to the people around you. So, like, how in the world is that going to work? And so the radical types, especially the intellectuals, they insist that, well, we can orient ourselves quite well with a kind of subjective hedonism. That's the hedonism of the moment and of subjective self-promotion, let's say. And the more Marxist types insist that we maneuver through the world merely as a consequence of our imposition of various schemes designed to accrue to us all the power. But there's no evidence that a hedonistic orientation towards life works, which is why most of us mature beyond the state we're at when we're 2 years old. And there's no evidence at all that an orientation towards power and domination actually constitutes a good strategy psychologically or socially. So all that's complete bloody rubbish as far as I can tell. And I think there's endless evidence now gathered on all sorts of fronts to indicate that that's the case. And then you might say, well, as I mentioned before, what's the alternative? And the alternative is something like full frontal confrontation with the most dreadful elements of existence. So in the Christian story, I could take it one step further, because this is also very interesting to note. So to imitate Christ in the Christian sense is to take on the full catastrophe of vulnerable existence, right? To face the reality of death, to face the reality of torture and betrayal at the hands of friends, enemies, and the state. To understand that that's part and parcel of destiny. But, you know, it doesn't end there, and that's quite interesting, too. I don't think that you've lived a very deep life or a very long life if you haven't come to understand at some point in your life that there are worse things than death and maybe worse things than pain. You can see this make itself manifest in people who develop post-traumatic stress disorder. People who have PTSD are generally not merely people who've been hurt by life. They're people who've been touched by malevolence. You know, and it's one thing to suffer, but it's another thing to suffer pointlessly at the hands of people who are doing nothing but trying to produce suffering. And that's not a bad definition of evil. And anyone with any sense who has paid any attention at all, for example, to the history of the 20th century, knows perfectly well that a sensible person clearly admits to the existence of evil. I mean, how else would you characterize what happened in Nazi Germany or in the Stalinist Soviet Union or in Maoist China or now in North Korea? I mean, if you don't think that's evil, then you don't attribute the same meaning to the word that I attributed to it, let's say. It's a stark reality. And so you might add that to one of the stark realities that you have to confront along with the contemplation of your own morality, is that you have to contend with the existence of malevolence. And the way that's laid out in the Christian story, which is a variant of the hero myth, by the way, the deepest variant of it, arguably, that you have to confront malevolence itself as well as mortal vulnerability in order to maximize your resilience and, weirdly enough, to foster the deepest levels of hope. You see that in the Christian story with the insistence that when Christ was crucified, he not only died in some real sense and had to go through all of that, but also had to descend to the depths of hell itself and to encounter the deepest abyss of human malevolence. And I would say that's also morally incumbent on us. I mean, this is a terrible thing to tell people, right? Because it really means that in order to become everything you could be, you have to face the worst that there is to face. But then again, like I said, if you think about that like a sensible person for 15 seconds, you understand very quickly that you're not going to develop your character by shrinking away from things. And you certainly aren't going to do that with your kids. You don't tell your kids, listen, son, the best thing to do in life is to shrink away from everything that's difficult. Not if you're someone who actually loves your son and wants to encourage him. You say instead, look, kiddo, there's something within you that can respond to any challenge, no matter how deep. And then maybe you encourage him to take on the most abysmal challenges in the hopes that he could succeed and become who he could be. And that's the fundamental, that's the appropriate fundamental orienting story that all healthy people and all thriving states has to act out and interpret the world through. And that's very useful to know, right? Voluntary confrontation with chaos and malevolence. That's the pathway to, well, that's the pathway to the eternal resurrection. That's the fundamental hero story. And that's the ultimate treasure. That's another way of thinking about it, right? That's how you gain your life by losing it. And there's nothing in that, as far as I can tell, that it isn't just true psychologically and psychophysiologically and scientifically and theologically. And so, well, that's probably a good place to end that.
That was spectacular. Exactly what we were wanting, talking about why all this occurs. There's a greater and higher purpose for it all. So we have some questions for Jordan. Who's got some questions out there, ladies and gentlemen? Yes.
I have like 6,000 questions, but I'll go with one. And just on a macro level, you know, I have three older children that are 23, 21, 19. I have an unbelievably blessed relationship with them. My son is my best friend in the world. So he goes off to college. My daughters go off to college. They are having incredibly high degrees of success. I couldn't be more proud of them and happy with how they've chosen their life path. But there is just such an unbelievable dynamic through the social dilemma and through the professors that they experience on an everyday basis. So my question is, what do you do? What do you do? You know, like with this world, how would we protect our children, our loved ones at the highest level?
I think you've already answered that question in your question. I mean, you said, first of all, that you have a very good relationship with your children. So congratulations on that. You said they're out there in the world, you know, making their way forward on multiple fronts simultaneously. They're doing everything they can to pursue the truth. That's what you do. And that doesn't mean that the victories that you attain are going to be obvious or easy. I do believe that there isn't anything that can stand up against the truth. And I believe that, I think, to some degree, because it just seems self-evident. It's like, if the truth is deeply reflective of the structure of reality, the claim that the lie can dominate is the claim that the unreal can defeat the real. Mm. And that's, you are literally insane if you believe that.
Yes.
So if your children are doing what they can to live by and speak the truth, they'll find their way. Mm. And the beneficial consequences of that wayfinding may not be immediately obvious, but that's also partly why you need to have faith. Because here's a good way of thinking about faith. Let's say you have faith in the truth. Well, but then you know, well, if I tell the truth, I'm going to get into trouble. And then you might think, well, then I better not say what I have to say, or I better lie in this situation, because otherwise there's going to be trouble. Well, that just means that you have misplaced faith in your current interpretation of trouble. Mm-hmm. Because a deeper faith says, and this is very useful to know, if you're telling the truth, whatever happens is the best thing that could happen.
Yeah.
Right. That's the statement of faith. So in the opening sections of Genesis, it's the word of God that creates habitable order out of chaos. And that's analogous to this process I described before of confronting chaos and generating order in consequence. Now, every time God uses truthful speech to create a new element of the world, he notes, and repeatedly, that this is good. Well, there's a, and that's, that process is also something that people can replicate, made as we are in the image of God. That's the thesis of the text. So the hypothesis there is that, well, if you're telling the truth, the world is laying itself out as it should. Now, you might not be able to see that because you're getting in trouble, at least in the short term, for what you have to say. But, you know, there's lots of times in your life where you do something that feels good right now and it isn't so good in a week. And there's plenty of times when the reverse is true. If you do something difficult now, it might get you in all sorts of trouble. And it turns out that in 2 years, that was the best decision you could have ever possibly made. Mm. Well, that's what the truth is like. It's like, it's not going to be easy,
but
it's going to be, it's going to establish the cosmos in the proper order. Mm. That's a statement of faith. And it sounds like you've already inculcated that in your kids. So I would say, you know, first, congratulations, and second, more power to them. And then sit back to some degree and let it play out. Encourage them to continue doing what they're doing and watch. And don't assume that if things are going sideways from time to time, that that means that, you know, the whole game is lost. I found, for example, this very peculiar thing to have learned is that the people who have most viciously attacked me have done me the greatest favor. Now, that sometimes took 2 or 3 years to unfold, and it was quite brutal in the, like, intermediary desert, let's say. But that's still how it inevitably worked out.
Thank you. Who's the next question?
Dr. Peterson, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you. In your book, The 12 Rules for Life, this is kind of playing off of what Sean may have said, but rule number 8, you said, tell the truth, or at least don't tell a lie. And so many times I find that, and you said there really are no atheists, just people who don't understand the God they serve.
And I,
to myself, sometimes I find that a lot of people, one of Tony's coaches was talking to me once, and he said, Michael, he goes, there's a difference between the truth and the whole truth. And that really dawned on me once. And some people tell the truth and exclude parts of things in life that shade the story. And I find that I do that with myself sometimes. And I was just curious if you could shade some light on that rule number 8. It really impacted me.
There's a couple of questions in there. Sure. I'll take that apart. So first of all, it's not a straightforward matter to tell the truth, partly because, like, what the hell do you know? Like, we're all steeped in ignorance, right? Yeah. So none of us are, in the final analysis, capable of telling the truth. We can get better at approximating the truth with time, but we don't have full access to all knowledge, and so everything we say is going to be partial. Now, having said that, it's still perfectly reasonable to distinguish between what's true and what isn't. How do you start doing that? Well, someone might say, I don't know how to distinguish between what's true and what's not true in the final analysis. And I would say to them, yeah, but you know, you'll find times in your life where you're inclined to say something or do something, to say something you know to be false or to do something you know to be wrong. Now, there may be times when you're ambiguous and ambivalent and you don't know, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about those times when you actually know. You know, and you can tell, because if you're going to say something that you know to be false, it fragments you internally and makes you weak. You feel the ground under your feet shifting. You're lying and you're betraying yourself. And I would say, and this was the purpose of that rule, was Well, stop doing that. First, stop doing that. Just stop saying all the things that you are saying that you know perfectly well to be false. And then at the same time, you can stop doing all the things you know that you shouldn't do. Well, what will happen as a consequence is that your speech will become more precise and your vision will become clearer because you're not cluttering yourself up with obvious falsehoods. And then if you continue doing that, your capacity to distinguish between what's true and what's false, it's more and more sophisticated. And if you do that long enough, you might actually get to the point where you could actually start to tell the truth instead of just not lying. At least some truths, at least some of the time. You know, and that's a pretty good start. And then that can expand out across time as you become expert at this. And then you might say, well, why bother doing that? And I can tell you why you should bother doing that. It's very straightforward. There will come a time in your life where you have to make a very fine decision. It might be one that your life depends on, or the life of someone you love, or a relationship depends on, or your business depends upon. And you'll be torn apart at the point where you have to make that decision. And if you can't rely on yourself at that moment to make the right decision, you could lose everything. Now, you might ask yourself, well, how do you ensure that you can rely on yourself in a situation like that? And I would say, well, if you spent 20 years practicing lying, you can be bloody well sure that when push comes to shove, you're going to make the wrong decision. You're going to want to be, when things get rough around you, you're going to want to be in a situation where your eye is clear and your tongue is sharp. And so if you've practiced diligently, one might even say religiously, to abide by the truth, then when you're cornered and the chips are down and you have to go left or right and one of them leads up and the other leads down, you're going to pick the right route. And if you know that, like if you meditate on that, if you understand that that's coming, that can scare you badly enough so that you'll stop saying things you know to be false. You'll pay the price for that. Then you add another interesting twist to that. You know, you said that often people, these are more subtle liars, they'll sort of half tell the truth. They'll tell the truth in a way that enables them to manipulate towards an end. Yeah, well, that's a particularly pathological form of lying. That's actually using the Lord's name in vain, by the way. You know that famous commandment? Do not use the Lord's name in vain. That doesn't mean to not swear. It means do not pretend to be serving God when you're not. And that's that kind of lie that you described. Telling the truth is a very tricky issue because you have to be aiming up in all ways to ensure that what you're relating isn't manipulatively self-serving at some subtle level. And it takes a long time to orient yourself at enough levels simultaneously so that you're no longer playing those sorts of games. But you do that by practicing. You do that by practicing not lying. It's like, you know, you try to make that a vow. And you can clear yourself up an awful lot. You know, a lot of what you do with people in psychotherapy, huge part of it, is you help them disentangle themselves from the web of lies that they found themselves trapped within. Decades of lies sometimes, or multiple lifetimes even, because you see, you know, you do see families from time to time that are so wrapped up in lies that it goes back, you know, three or four generations. It's just lies nonstop at every possible level. And so all of that has to be sorted out. And you often are doing that working as a psychotherapist. You can do that with a sustained moral effort on your own behalf. I mean, part of what you're doing if you're a religious practitioner and you go and confess is that you're trying to remind yourself about what lies you're telling. And you do that so that maybe you can stop doing it. And it's a practice. You know, and you can get good at what you practice.
So really what the Dickens process is, if you think about it, that we all do, right? People finding what the lies are that are holding them back and changing them right then and there with enough emotion. Question, Mary.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Thanks, Tony and Sage. I've heard you say, Dr. Peterson, and what I love about these stories of mythology and biblical stories is, I've heard you say, it de-isolates us and it gives us something that's like, wow, I'm not alone. A lot of people feel this way. And, you know, hearing you explain this and sitting through some of the speakers that we've had earlier, I have the feeling that, wow, this world is continuing, like the chaos keeps coming. And it feels like overwhelming when I really think about the big picture of it sometimes and the complexity of it all and the things like, I will never understand this, whether it's financials or AI or all that the world is moving into, the dynamics of countries. I'm shaking just talking about it. I'm wondering, my experience is almost like there's these islands of order. I find that in my family. I find that in a safe community, mom and dad, friends. But it's like, I don't know if that's a woman's perspective of like, wow, there's a lot going on out there. And I'm just trying to like cling to my people and something that I understand. Is that even a proper representation?
I think you've got it right. I mean, first of all, it's inevitably the case that, what would you say? You confront an infinite expanse of ignorance. In some fundamental way, things are always going to be ultimately beyond you. You see that in the biblical stories that insist, for example, that people can only see the back of God. And so it's an existential reality that there's going to be more coming at you than you can manage and master. And then, of course, the question is, how do you deal with that? And you deal with that like a sailor deals with the ocean in a boat. You know, there's a lot of ocean, but you can stay afloat and you can navigate forward. And so then you might ask, well, how do you do that? Well, we talked about that a little bit today in terms of orienting stories. You know, you have to put forward some courage and some faith, and you have to confront the things that are obstacles in your path. And that attitude helps turn you into something that's united psychologically, right? That can strengthen you personally. But then there's the social element to that, because if we share the same story that we should confront chaos and make order, and we do that together, then now we have social unity around us. And that means that we have the strength of numbers. You know, part of the reason that I've been able to maneuver through the political turmoil that I've been admired in is because I have great family. They're very supportive. And I have a lot of friends who are tough people, and they were behind me. And I have a broader social community, and that fortifies me. And that's the kind of unity in numbers and in belief that does help you maintain your integrated spirit through the chaos of life. That's not weakness. That's a necessary observation that part of your sanity depends on the proper harmony you establish with the social community. Now, the female part of that might be that the female locus of concentration is more local, right? And more familial. But that's not a bad thing. Someone has to bind the damn families together. And to some degree, we're islands unto ourselves, but to some degree, we're all members of family first and then community second. And it's not inappropriate at all to make the family level of social integration a fundamental point of concern. And I do think that's the natural resting place of women, partly because they have to take care of infants and young children. And that's not a weakness. It's just a difference of approach. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And it's a virtue. Now, it does mean that we still have to face the complex problem of how you integrate the integrated family in the broader community. And I would say that's a more masculine problem. Now, that doesn't mean men and women can't address the same damn problem, but all things being equal, there's still a different level of natural concern. None of that's reason to feel guilty. You know, when I counsel women, for example, on their career development, say, well, look, you know, once you have a child, your fundamental concern should be your child. And that's true whether you're a father or a mother, but it's particularly true if you're a mother, especially if you have an infant. Then women will say, well, what do I do about my career? You know, I feel guilty because I'm not pursuing my career, or I feel guilty when I'm pursuing my career that I'm not attending to my child. Women can be screwed both ways in that matter. I'd say, well, look, it's perfectly reasonable for you to model successful adaptation to the broader social community for your kids. You know, you have to get your act together. You have to get your family together. Then you have to integrate you and your family in the broader community. You should be serving all of that simultaneously. That's a virtue. And I, you know, women might approach that family first and broader social world second, and maybe men the other way around. You know, it's a loose rule of thumb, but both of those approaches can work just fine, and they work great in tandem.
Beautiful. One more.
Dr. Peterson, thank you. The question I have for you is, there's a lot of chaos in the world, and I sometimes wonder maybe have a hard time deciding what part of the chaos am I responsible for uniquely confronting. So Tony's very passionate about ending hunger, for example, with their billions of meals. And I have kind of racked my brain over time and not found that same kind of passion for a particular, you know, cause like that. And I wonder how might a person, you know, make that choice?
That's a great question. Well, I'll tell you a little story first that's worthwhile knowing. So it's a story from Exodus, and it's the story of the burning bush, which is kind of a mysterious story. And so here's how that story essentially goes. So Moses is trying to find his way, right? He's trying to identify his destiny, and he's off wandering down a pathway, minding his own business one day, and something attracts his attention. It sort of glitters and glimmers off to the side, and it pulls him towards it. Now, he has to decide to step off the path and go investigate. The story makes that quite clear. And this is a burning bush, not a burning forest. It's not so overwhelming that you can't avoid it. All right. And so Moses goes and decides he's going to go investigate this thing that captures his interest. And as he gets closer to it, he starts to hear a divine voice. And the first thing the voice tells him as he gets closer is that he's on sacred ground and that he should take off his shoes. And then he starts to interact with this strange phenomenon, this burning bush, and God himself reveals his name to Moses. So what does that mean? Well, here's one thing it means. Lots of things grip our interest, and not really of our own accord, right? You can't really pick what you're interested in. It picks you. Now, you can pick whether or not you pursue it or not, and you can pick how diligently you pursue it. But the interest itself manifests itself in a kind of autonomous manner. Now, you might ask yourself, well, what would happen if you really pursued what gripped your interest? And the answer is, well, you get deeper and deeper into it. And the deeper you get into something, the more you're beginning to tread on sacred ground, because there's no difference between sacred and deep. It's the same idea. And the idea in the burning bush story is that if you attend to what compels your interest with enough diligence, the nature of being itself will reveal itself to you. And that's true. So you might say, well, how does that burning bush appear then in the confines of normal life? And I would say it appears in two ways. It appears in the guise of what interests you. And it appears in the guise of what sets itself before you as a problem. So I would say, as a starter, you can try this. Do this over a couple of days. Write down what bothers you. You know, there's going to be things about life, about the current political situation, about the details of your personal life, your relationships with other people that bother you. Now, a million things could bother you, and some things do. Those are your problems. And your destiny is in your problems. And then I would also say, well, watch yourself for a couple of weeks and see what you're doing when what you're doing appears meaningful, right? When your interest is gripped and you're compelled, Because when you're in the place where you are, when your interest is compelled and you're gripped, you're where you should be. And one of the things you want to learn is how to be there more. You have to kind of treat yourself like a stranger to figure that out because, well, as you said, you know, you haven't been able to find your path precisely. Well, that means you don't know who the hell you are. Well, that's what it means fundamentally. You know, you may know some things about yourself, but you don't know yourself as deeply as you might. You have to understand that there's a certain degree of arbitrary strangeness about you and about the things that will compel you and grip you. And you need to discover what those are. And paying attention can help. It's like, where am I when I think I'm where I should be? And what am I doing? And you can ask yourself that over a 2-week period or a 1-month period, like you're asking someone you don't know. Then the other thing I would recommend more concretely is I have this program called Future Authoring on a website called selfauthoring.com. And what Future Authoring program helps you do is to develop a comprehensive vision. And it's a great thing, by the way, to have your employees do if you run a company. It'll make them much more productive and also more psychologically integrated. So the way that this program works is that it asks you, this is a good meditative exercise, I suppose it's a form of prayer. Imagine 5 years from now, and I literally mean imagine this, okay? Imagine 5 years from now. Now, here's the deal. You can have what you want and you need, and you can be who you want to be, but you have to figure out what that is. That's the price you have to pay. So now you have to fantasize. It's like, okay, if I was who I would want to be, and if I had what I needed and I wanted, what would that look like? Write it down for 15 minutes. You're not going to get it right. Just sketch it out. And then you can do the opposite, which is, all right, now if I let my bad habits and inadequacies have the upper hand and order me in, what sort of hell could I occupy in 5 years? That's useful to know too, because that's a good way of specifying where you don't want to go. The first part of the exercise helps you specify where you do want to go. The second part helps you specify where you don't want to go. Then you have something to run away from and something to run toward, and that's good for maximizing motivation. And then the rest of the exercise helps people strategize. And so you might say, well, I don't exactly know who I want to be or where I want to be or what I want. And I would say, well, here are some hints. If your intimate relationship with what you wanted, what would it look like? If your friendships were constructed the way you wanted them to be, these are questions you have to ask yourself. What would that look like? If you were educated to the limits of your intelligence, what educational strategy would you have to pursue? What job or career would you want or need if you could have what you wanted or needed? How should you use your time outside of work? How would you take care of yourself mentally and physically? What services might you render to your family and your community if you could do it in the manner you wanted? And that's 7 different questions, you know, to sort of differentiate your life. Man, it's worth spending a few days figuring that out. We did that with university students before they went to university, and it dropped their dropout rate 50%. 90 minutes of writing dropped their dropout rate 50% and raised their grade point average 35%. So you need a vision, man. You need a vision. And you can develop a vision by pursuing what's interesting to you. You can develop a vision by taking the problems that beset you seriously. And you can develop a vision by working with yourself to develop a vision. You know, let's say you love someone, you know, maybe you have a friend, maybe it's your wife, maybe a child, and you really love this person, and you say to them, I really like to know what you want, you know, and knowing that, maybe I can figure out how to help you. If you would let me know, you can ask yourself the same damn question. You know, imagine that you dared to assume that you were worth attending to and that it would be okay if things worked out optimally for you in the best possible way. Just imagine for a moment that that was okay. Well, then you could ask yourself, well, all right, what would that look like? That's an unbelievably useful exercise. So that's a prayer, man. That's a prayer fundamentally. And a prayer, that's a prayer devoted towards the seeking of a revelation.
Jordan, we're right on the time. I know you have tight time and we're down to the last minute of it. We just want to thank you for being a prayer answered for so many of us in the world by your example of love and of integrity and of joy. Please give it up for Jordan, ladies and gentlemen.
Jordan, it's Sage. We just wanted to say thank you. It's such an honor to have you here, and thank you for your sincerity. Thank you for your goodness. Thank you for your brilliant mind, your generous heart, and for shedding illumination on this beautiful path called human life. You're doing it so beautifully. Love to you and Tammy, and God bless. We love you.
See you soon.
Thank you.